you. Thank you very much, Jen. Thank you for that introduction. Good evening. Thanks also to Paul, Casey, for inviting me here tonight to read Cork. My first time reading in Cork. First time reading in Munster, I think actually. Yeah. So I've got a couple of tenuous connections with Cork for some of these poems, and I'll just point them out as we go along. And I'll just start off with this poem, which was actually published in Southward, the last print edition of Southward, which came out a couple of months ago. And it's a poem that came about. Sometimes in the newspaper you hear about these cases of a body that might have been left over the Christmas holidays. Somebody didn't look in on somebody, and the body was kind of found after the Christmas holidays or what have you. But last year I got on the train going to work, and I opened the newspaper and I read about a body that hadn't been found since 1966, which is the year I was born. So it kind of gave me the first line of the poem. And the woman's name was Hedwiga Golic. So there's a little note. Hedwiga Golic, born 1924, died 1966, found 2008. All my life, Hedwiga Golic, you sat dead in your armchair in front of the telly, a luxury item in the Yugoslavia of 66, the newspaper notes, nursing a dried up cup of tea. When the bailiffs finally broke in, even the country you died in no longer existed. The night you sat down to watch TV, I'm sure there was nothing decent on. There never is. Just the same old rubbish. Now, dying in front of a screen is what most people do for a living. Like some of your neighbours, I'm sure, who never thought to look in on you in over 40 years. Lovely people. Best of neighbours. Only there for you when you want them. Thank you. And this is a poem. There's been an awful lot of stuff about Charles Darwin in the news, because this year is his 200th anniversary of his birth, and I think last week was the 150th anniversary of the publication of The Origin of Species. And Darwin is somebody that all my reading life I've been reading about Darwin, endless biographies and books about Darwin, probably because I often say this, that people who write poetry, I often think are frustrated something else. If they would have wanted to do something else, and what I would have loved to have done was become a zoologist. So I think that's one of the interests that I've always had in Darwin. But I just think he's somebody that I've always been very, very interested in the life and interested in the theory. So this is a poem about a photograph of Darwin called Charles Darwin at Down, circa 1818. Dressed in the authority of black, a devil's chaplain with a white beard, you stand sinistral on your veranda. The creeper on your right has no leaves. It must be autumn, winter perhaps. Each twist of that twig has been observed. Moses has descended from the mountain and is uneasy among the fish who flopped from pool to pool and went on to inherit the earth. All that Victorian quackery. The early morning cold water cured, skin soaked and stretched in vinegar, and the sipping of ozonized water. They have lined your skin, made a bag of your eyes, and left you a haggard old evolutionist. As a young man, Fitzroy noted your nose lacked energy and determination. What would he make of it now? It too has evolved. Only the eyes are separate of species, peering out from under your beetle brows. Darwin, a reluctant but soft subject, icon on my mantelpiece, gazing beyond your century. Drunk, I've passed you off to visitors of my grandfather. Paterfamilias, was your routine broken that day? it must have taken weeks to reassemble it. That daily constitutional, the sand walk thinking path, where I'm told a brood of squirrels ran up your back, mistaking you for something slower and friendlier than a man. You walked troubled among the dogwood, hazel and hornbeam, raised by your own hands. From the veranda, those trees have matured to the height of spires. Your right eye sees that nature is prodigal. The left eye, lazy and askance, discerns the clumsy and blundering movement of it all. I have a plan here. I come from Drogheda in County Louth, and this is a poem called The Carberry Lunch in Louth. And there's a little epigraph at the beginning, and it's from a book that was published in the 1940s, Anger in the Sky, by an American writer called Susan Earp. And I had this quote in my head for years, and I tracked it down. I don't know where I came across it first. It wasn't in the book, because I never actually read the book. But the quote is, "Millions long for immortality who do not know what to do with themselves on a rainy Sunday afternoon." And I kind of include myself in that as well. Here, in the half-lit church of the Sunday Carvery, the nose smarts with the sweat of an entire gymnasium of vegetables boiled beyond belief. Colours washed into one sodden mass, and the unshaven bacon bristles the ring of fat that holds the bloody beef together. Flashbacks to cabbage and forced eating. We queue for this, while others are lamped by widescreen TV, staring through the thick air of John Player Blue. Tonight, it might be the Banner County, the Wee County, or the Cap, and the voice commentates as if from under a wet newspaper. Childhood Sundays haunted by that drone, coming from car radios by the sea, where solitary men sat in Satori and summer heat. We take our poison, toddlers scream, and grown-ups in acrylic green jerseys drink lager like milk, in a culture of the coronary, some dispossession taking place. Actually did read that poem in my hometown, and they didn't seem to mind. This is a very tenuous connection with Cork. It refers to Elizabeth Bowen. There was a house in Tipperary, and I wrote a whole series of sonnets about this house in Tipperary, and this is kind of one of the but it's one that kind of alludes to Elizabeth Bowen and her book, Bowen's Court. It's a fantastic book. It's one of my favourite writers. And it's very tenuous, what I was thinking of it. Any time I pass by Farahy, I nip in there to have a look around at the ruins. And over the years, I've pinched bits of marble and stuff like that, because it's all rubble, you know, but I've loads of them.
Give it back.
I've got a big piece of marble which I've identified, because the book is so detailed, I've identified that it might have been from the fireplace in the hall that you go in. It's just all in rubble now. And this there's 14 sonnets about this house, but this is one that kind of got me out of the house and outside. It's called Singing Gate. A clutch of cars driving to the mouth of the valley for a hike up to the heavens, when the heavens open down on us. Declining to get drenched, as you and the others headed off in the downpour, I dithered, then dipped into Bowen's Court, somewhere in the 1840s, in a car assailed, buffeted by wind and rain, and the fields outside, washed desolate as the Avengers I travelled through in a stranded car. Soaked, you poured back with a story of how you heard music in the wet wilderness below, its source, the high bar of the gate you crossed, rain-rusted, sound holes, and the wind wildly playing them. I remember Anthony Cronin once said that you know if you're writing poetry in Ireland, you should never write about your childhood, because it's been lots of bad poetry about your childhood. And I never wrote about my childhood, probably because I had a relatively happy one. But I find maybe it's probably because I'm in middle age now that I've started writing about poems about childhood. I've written a whole series of them recently. So this is one. And it's called Letting the Cat Out of the Bag. When my father stole into the scullery, having faltered over fields from the flooded quarry, which naturally we were warned against and was bottomless, he announced he'd never carry out an act like it again. Having earlier gathered the kittens with their mother and weighted the whole shebang into a loose-stitched sack, all the more strange, even alarming, when within a week the mother arrived back to sit on the windowsill and observe for some years hence my father's uneasy comings and goings. And this is a recent poem that was published, and I've written about Japan quite a bit. I lived there in the early 90s, and I went back 2 years. I hadn't been back in about 15 years, and I went back 2 years and 2 years ago, and kind of realised this thing of, I have this habit of kind of going back to places that you've been, and kind of, in one sense, kind of realizing the pointlessness of going back sometimes to these places. And this poem is called Kyoto Koan, and the Koan is that notion of a little kind of a moment of lucidity, or a little kind of a little epiphany. Kyoto Koan. And it's kind of also based on those kind of classical Chinese travel poems or Japanese travel poems, something to think of. Kyoto Koan. Back in Kyoto, and in the morning, plans to set out north to Arashiyama, the old neighborhood, and from there to carry on to the surrounding mountains, to Jōjaku-ji Temple, which in early autumn would afford good views east over Kyoto. Before setting out, recalled reaching Jōjaku-ji 15 years earlier, during that harsh winter, and now what seems like another life. The temple laid rest by snow, pristine emptiness, pagodas competing for whiteness, steps of powder which now stop me in my tracks. The necessary need of not returning to Jōjaku-ji, not now, not ever. And I wrote this. This is probably a Celtic Tiger poem. In that it's. There's an awful lot of jargon floating around, corporate jargon, about 5 or 6 years ago, and I wrote this poem, and it's a poem that you just keep adding on to, because you hear all this jargon all the time. And strangely enough, this poem, it ended up on the business program, on the radio, and then it ended up on a religious program on the BBC, and it's a piece of doggerel, and it's a terrible fear that I'm going to probably be the poem you'd be remembered for. But it's about this kind of notion, and even this corporate language which you hear. I just heard a new one the other day. Somebody was talking about low-hanging fruit, meaning opportunities, you know. And I work in the arts, but, you know, sometimes you think you're working in Microsoft, because the jargon is used even in the arts world. If anything, it's even worse. So this is called corporate ink. At the end of the day, there are some issues we'll just have to park. Ring fence for the future are put on hold while we pencil in and set to the bigger picture. Let's find a window in which we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, where we've cleared the air and still see a level playing field, long-fingered ahead of us, where goalposts haven't shifted. We could firefight while we're at the coalface and speak with synergy the same language, broadly speaking, so to speak, or just cut to the chase. Start by putting flesh on the bones as we hit the ground running for that ballpark figure, seeing eye to eye and talking like grown-ups. It's entirely your call and simply all freewheeling from here as we strike a balance or even a chord. It's all sound regardless. In any event, should we need to fly in the face of a downslide, run what challenged us up the flagpole to see if it flutters for that bumpy ride ahead, we could put this one to bed, circle the wagons, and bring this baby down. And I'll read one more. I'll just finish with this one. It's called Tar Kicking, and I don't drive, but I know that if you're going to buy a car, or if you're selling a car and somebody comes around and starts kicking the tires, they're not going to buy the car. And tire kicking is kind of become a little personal word for kind of wasting time or killing time. And I suppose this is kind of a poem almost about probably about retirement or something along those lines. So I'll finish with this. Thanks very much. Thanks for listening. Tire kicking. There might be a halting somewhere east of Drumshambo, where the small talk is of angle grinders, carburetor crankshafts, and bent axles. And if I knew the form, I wouldn't make strange lounging outside a garage in overalls, tire kicking the days away, and knowing the pedigree of every passing vehicle, leaning expertly to each new arrival on the forecourt. I sometimes straighten my back and nose the wind for change, while the radio, oily as a discarded car battery, would blabber on the hour with news of the world. Thank you very much.